Can we talk about the Queen's Loves You on?
I think that you could really easily look at Queen's Loves You as an event that was fluffy as opposed to action if you chose to look at it through that lens.
On April 7th, 2011, students from Queen's University made the national news. A picture appeared in the Globe and Mail. It shows rows of solemn-looking students decked out in their Queen's shirts and wearing their TAMs. The photo's caption explains that the university had dealt with the deaths of several students that year, and this event, called Queen's Loves You, was a reaction to those deaths. Queen's Loves You started as a Facebook page and met a groundswell of support. Organizer Kevin Imrey explains.
So I'm Kevin Imrey. I'm a fourth-year student. I'm doing politics and history here at Queen's. I was involved with the Queen's Loves You campaign that was on campus. I was working at the Queen's Walk Home Service, and I started a Facebook group. And the response was very substantial very quickly. So I didn't really start a campaign. And even after that, I didn't do much more than communicate with people about coordinating. Kind of, what do you want to do? Okay, if you want to do it, then do it. It's difficult to talk about the situation because you always want to respect the privacy of anyone involved. Based on the news that I was hearing on campus, I felt concerned. My friends were very down. There was a lot of concern among them, and they were having conversations about how they were worried about what was going on at Queen's and what kind of place this was. So my response to that was to say that this is a community where you can get support. It wasn't coming from an incredible breadth of knowledge in the mental health field. I'm not a professional, but it was more just like a reaction to what was going on and an attempt to share a message that I thought students would be comfortable with, or at least my friends, because that's who I invited. There was a chalk alley. Some students decorated their house. A lot of photographs were taken of that. I didn't know that was being done. Students dressed in tricolor. They were able to come to booths around campus and they could talk to people or they could do something. It was just students kind of getting in touch and seeing what they wanted to do. Someone painted a banner. And there were a bunch of other things that I'm sure went on that I didn't know about.
Imrey emphasizes that his only intention was to bring his community together. At one point, he tells me he isn't happy that in some ways it turned into a pep rally. You can see pictures of the day online, in university publications, on blogs, on Facebook. Students hug each other, they cheer and sing the Queen's fight song. There are close-ups of the messages chalked on the sidewalks. You'll always be somebody, someone. Thank you for a great first year. Someone somewhere loves you. How much do we love Queens? So much. This didn't go down well with everyone.
It made me angry because it was just so misinformed, which just made it seem disingenuous. The idea that the struggles that like I go through and have gone through is simply because of lack of like love is just wrong.
Yeah, and that's fair because I know that for some people and their experience, it didn't reflect what they needed or what they wanted. I don't know if it necessarily entirely inaccurately represents people's experience with mental ill health. I think that people deal with that situation and any matter of ill health, even beyond this, in a lot of different ways. And I think that different people need different things to support them.
At that time, I was too close to it and sort of was just really angry at this event that was happening and was just like, thought that it totally missed the point and like thought that like these people didn't understand anything that they were doing. Half a year later, from where I stand and where I look at it, I really do see the Queen's community reeling from the loss of so many students taking their own lives and being so lost at what to do and not having any guidance on the part of the administration, and students who have dealt with experiences of depression, anxiety, and like so many different things on so many different levels coming together to try to support each other. And I can see the earnestness of that and like the honesty and like people wanting to support each other.
Thousands of people participated in Queen's Loves You. Obviously, the event tapped into something compelling, and a range of commemorative videos, photo spreads, and blog posts testify to the power that the event held for many. But in the midst of the focus on good vibes offered by Queens Loves You, a different kind of conversation about mental health was also taking place at the university.
I'm Kavita, and I'm a part of OPRIG. Basically, we participated in a rally in the springtime that was called What Do You Want? And it was outside of Richardson Hall, the principal's office, and sort of students had come together to sort of articulate their desires and demands of the university in terms of what they wanted to see changed in regards to mental health supports at Queens. So we heard from a lot of students. There was like a Facebook event where people posted online about what they want, and when they showed up, we heard a lot of people talking about wanting more resources, wanting more counseling, wanting more full-time staff support, wanting a full-time psychiatrist, more than one potentially, a lot of these different things that the university should be able to provide for us, no question. Mm-hmm. We heard a lot of people sort of talking about stigma and also very like binaristic understandings of what mental health is, mm-hmm. And wanting to expand that conversation. What we were trying to talk about, I guess, is the ways in which mental health intersects with and is affected by all these other lived realities and oppressions. Mm-hmm. So basically, you can't talk about mental health without talking about classism. You can't talk about mental health without talking about racism. You can't talk about it without talking about sexism and ableism and like homophobia. So we created a space where we could talk about those things in conjunction with one another. And when we had tried to do that at the rally, we were sort of shot down as sort of saying we're detracting from the point, and people weren't necessarily understanding that like experiences of racism or homophobia directly impact your mental health.
The debate about how best to frame mental health issues at Queens is yet to be resolved.
I'm Mike Condra from Health Counseling and Disability Services.
I asked the Director of Health Counseling and Disability Services for his take on the matter.
I'm the director of the department, and we provide services, physical health, mental health, disability accommodation arrangement for all university students at Queens. I think at the time of the year when it happened, it represented a reaction by some students to a situation that probably at the time felt like it was just pretty bleak. And in that sense, I think, okay, good stuff, good thing that happened. I think that it's like lots of other situations like this. Okay, take that now and map it onto a whole series of ongoing things, like reaching out to people, letting people know. So it's like taking all of what happened to Queens Love You and saying, okay, what can you extract from all of that and then continue to feed in so that it promotes a real cultural change, not just a one-off event. The one-off event was good to get the ball rolling. I also think that part of the one-off event is that then afterwards we need to get together and say, okay, why did these other folks feel like it wasn't really such a good idea? And let's do some learning from that. And I realize it's probably a little bit naive, but to be honest, to me, that's how we're going to transform that Queens Love You experience into an ongoing thing. It's like, okay, actually, we didn't include or we didn't think about people whose experience is different from ours.
I'm no longer a student at Queens, and I didn't participate in either Queens Loves You or What Do You Want? But it seems to me that the conversation that emerged at the university last April encapsulates a lot of the wider cultural conversation about mental health. People want to talk about it, and people want to understand it, but they don't necessarily know how. I'm Veronica Blackburn. This is Some Remain So, Conversations About Mental Health. I've had more than one bout of major depression, and it's had a big impact on my life. When I don't know what to do, I read. The last time I was depressed, I tried to read up on what I was experiencing. Recently, I found a scrap of paper from that time with a thought that I'd written down in reaction to what I'd been reading. "You're not allowed to speak depression when you're in it," it said. "We only want to hear about it when you're cured." I remember writing that note. I was thinking, on the one hand, that it's really painful to hear about the experience of mental ill health, especially, as is statistically likely the case, if you or someone you love has been there. But I also meant that you can't speak about depression when you're in it, because that kind of narrative literally can't be heard. We want to hear stories of healing, of overcoming obstacles, of coming out on the other side. We don't like to think that this may not be how the story goes. There's a word for this fear.
Stigma.
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 Stigma. Stigma is a big, big issue.
Stigma not only shapes what we're able to hear about mental health, but it also shapes how we deal with mental health problems. At its worst, stigma becomes both cause and effect, as you can hear in the next story.
Tiffany Jones
is a professor of history at California State University, San Bernardino. Her research is focused on the mental health system in apartheid South Africa, but her experience with mental health has also been personal.
I'm a little bit confused about dates. I'm a historian, which is terrible because I'm terrible with dates. I think it was around 1991 where I was put into a psychiatric ward in Humber Memorial Hospital in Toronto. And I went in really because I was having a really rough time. I was young. I was 19. I'd been trying to live by myself since I was 16. I dropped out of school trying to support myself. And my roommate at the time said to me, you may want to go to the hospital because you've been crying for like 2 days. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can just go and ask them for help. And I said, okay, I agree to it. And I went in and I got checked in. And little did I know, 3 months later, I was still there. And I felt like I could never get out. And, you know, and so I was there for a long time, you know, 3 months. And then on and off, they would let me out for a few days. And then I'd go and I'd have to come back in. So you gradually kind of built up. Slowly but surely, you could get privileges to go out. And then also when I was in the hospital, they also recommended electric shock, and I didn't know anything about it. And those were, I don't know what damage those did to me. And people's faces when I tell them that I had ECT is quite interesting because people have the image of, you know, the one flew over the cuckoo's nest. So what they would do is you would, you know, you'd basically be knocked out. You'd be rolled in on a gurney into a room and into a waiting room. You'd be given, you know, some sort of sedative, be put out. And then when you wake up, you literally felt like your head had been squished in because they had put electrodes onto your head and shocked you. And most people wouldn't even know their names. They wouldn't know who they are, where they are. And I remember waking up and not knowing where I was or why I was there, but at least I remembered my name and it would come back gradually. And that happened 3 times. And after the 3rd time, I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. This is not doing anything. And my doctor listened, which luckily enough, he did.
This is the image of mental ill health that terrifies people. Checking into a psychiatric ward, losing the freedom to make your own decisions, electroshock therapy.
I do think that the bad rap that it has, you know, it has it for a reason, because it is a brutal treatment. You're shocking people. You're pushing large amounts of electricity through people's heads and saying that this is okay. And it's not okay.
Tiffany points out that she did have to give consent for ECT, but she also remarks that she was pushed pretty hard to do so.
And I must say that I did see a lot of people who had ECT come out of their vegetative states or come out of some sort of their whatever mental affliction that they felt at that time and change. And so I think that was one of the reasons why you had to agree to it.
If stigma is about fear, then Tiffany's story is a good example of what people fear will happen if they experience mental ill health. So in that sense, this kind of story is a cause. It's what perpetuates stigma. But stigma also structures the experience. In many ways, what happened to Tiffany is stigma's effect. Diagnosed as mentally ill, Tiffany became an object rather than a subject of treatment. Because her doctors had determined that there was something wrong with her brain, it seems they could see no point in asking for her thoughts.
Nobody ever asked me, have you been eating properly? You know, have you been sleeping? I don't ever recall anybody ever asking me that question. They just gave me pills. And that was the solution. When you think about psychiatry and you think about mental health and you think about people who are in the system, I kind of always wondered, when is somebody going to actually ask me about me? I got asked about how I felt you know, about how do you feel today? Are you tired? Are you hungry? Are you angry? Are you sad? So I got a lot of that. But nobody ever asked me why I felt that way, which was kind of odd. And yeah, the doctors and the psychiatrists never asked me why, you know. And I remember thinking, even after I was released and going to his office, when is he ever going to ask me why? Yeah, it was a kind of odd. And I always had this image that, you know, you sit on a couch and you tell your life story. It was never that. It was always, here's your prescription. Thank you very much. How are you feeling? And it wasn't like, so why are you feeling like that?
It may be that in Tiffany's case, stigma made a crisis into a mental health problem. Her diagnosis got her help, but it also kept her in the position of needing help.
I have a love-hate relationship with the whole mental health system in the fact that it did allow me, because the extra services of the housing and the support allowed me to finish school and basically move out of that system, but it was very difficult for me to get out of that system. I literally had to leave the country to get out of the system. I decided to go back to South Africa and live with my mother. And that's how I got out. But it was, for most people, they didn't have that choice. And they're probably, I suspect, some of the people who were living in that housing are probably still living in that housing. You know, I've been living drug-free and, you know, basically just getting proper sleep and exercising and eating healthy for, you know, since probably 1995. And I have never had any depression or, you know, the same kind of extent or any mental illness since. So, which makes me exceptionally angry about the fact that for 3 months I was put in an institution, and then for 2 years I lived within this housing and living on pills and taking the proper pills when I didn't necessarily need to be. And maybe at that time I maybe needed some help, but I don't think the pills and the shocks was the way, you know, was the right way. I guess I didn't know what to call myself for many years because I didn't feel, you know, I felt that I was one of those people that was put into the system, you know, incorrectly, and I shouldn't have been in there. And I found that there was a community, a very strong community actually in Canada, of people who call themselves psychiatric survivors. And what it is it's somebody who has survived the psychiatric system. I don't know where they came the term from, but it is a common term now that many people who have survived this psychiatric institutions, been in an institution, gotten out, and feel that they were treated badly within the system, call themselves psychiatric survivors. And that's how I see myself. I see myself as a survivor of that system. I've gotten out of the system. I'm no longer connected to it. I no longer take drugs. I don't need to be in that system. It's also a very active word in the sense that you're usually advocating against many of the abuses that are still going on within the system as well. So many of the psychiatric survivors are also political activists within the mental health world. They speak up about their experiences, and they usually advocate for better services and to stop some of the abuses. And one of the large battles that they are waging is against the use of ECT.
What happened to Tiffany happened almost 20 years ago. A lot has changed in that time, much of it for the better. But recent anti-stigma campaigns have made people more aware of the biological components of mental ill health, and Tiffany sees a potential concern with this.
And you can tell I'm confused about whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing, this movement towards biological, you know, that mental health is always seen as a biological thing. I know for me it wasn't. And so I had to admit to myself that I was making choices in my life as well that were not positive, and I had to change a lot of that as well. And that really helped me go on and live a very fruitful life. I'm very happy in my life today. I don't think I would be able to get there if I had just gone the whole pharmaceutical route and just taken drugs. You know, it just, I wouldn't be happy I don't think if that was what was given to me as my solution and only my solution.
Emphasizing the biological components of mental ill health combats stigma by emphasizing the elements of mental health that are beyond an individual's will. But there is another potential message as well.
That stigma is something that fear is something that I think, personally, the pharmaceutical companies play on. That's why the drugs are so, because you can take them in private. You don't have to go and speak to somebody, right? You don't have to go to group therapy. You don't have to kind of admit that, you know, you're battling, and people don't want to admit that they're battling in their daily lives, mm-hmm. or they're not able to pay their bills or whatever it is. People don't, it's this unspoken kind of thing that exists in our society. And so, yeah, certainly the stigma exists. And I think it's very difficult for a lot of people to talk about their experiences, because suddenly when you do, people think, oh, okay, everything you do suddenly becomes suspect. And I think that's a huge problem, and that will perpetuate it perpetuates the stigma, but it also perpetuates the fact that, you know, people will just try and find that easy solution, which is the pill or, you know, ECT or whatever it is.
Mental ill health, like other kinds of health, does have a physical component. But mental health is also, uniquely, where the physical, psychological, and emotional meet. If we are to understand mental health, we need to consider it through the lenses of both the mind and the brain.
I'm Kate Harkness from the psychology department at Queen's. Well, I have a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Oregon, and then I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh, and I've been here as a professor for about 11 years. Probably the biggest thing is the misconception that that depression is something that people can just get over, and that somehow if they can't get over it, they lack the moral fiber or the strength of character to get out of it. And I think the reason for that is that depression is certainly on a continuum from the normal everyday way that we would, you know, that the lay public uses depression. Oh, I'm so depressed today, to these people with severe clinical manifestations of depression. So I think when we use the term colloquially, we don't mean severe clinical depression, but it makes it hard to understand what severe clinical depression is when we use the same word to explain both things. So I think the general public still lacks an understanding of what the syndrome of major depression is all about, and that these people really can't just snap out of it, that they often require specialized treatment. So I think that that's the one thing that I notice. And I think there's also this understanding that everyone understands mental illness, and that it's easy to understand, and that you don't really need specialized knowledge. That also comes up sometimes, and it leads to, you know, everyone thinks they might know, they might have a strategy for mm-hmm. you know, how to address it, without realizing that there's actually a large research literature backing it up, and that you can't just pull something out of your hat and think, well, this might work, without looking at the literature to see what actually works.
One popular image of antidepressants and other medications for mental ill health conditions is that they are either poisonous foreign agents or that they are the crutches of lazy people. These are qualities we don't ascribe to antibiotics, but this is probably why, as Dr. Harkness observes, so many people feel that they should either get over their mental ill health through sheer force of will or devise their own treatments for it. But as another researcher at Queen's points out, mood disorders are chemical processes that have observable chemical effects.
I'm Rumen Milev. I'm a head of Department of Psychiatry at Queen's University, and I'm also head of Department of Psychiatry at Kingston General Hospital, Hotel Dew Hospital, Providence Care, and Frontenac Community Mental Health Services. Mood disorders, depression, anxiety, they seem to be disorders of the brain in the same way like other medical conditions of the heart or pancreas or liver can affect the respective organs. The difference being that if you have a disorder of the liver, the symptoms will come from the liver. You will find the elevated liver enzymes or whatever the situation might be. When the disorder affects the brain, the symptoms are in the mind, because that's where mind operates. But because mind is so central to our day-to-day functioning, this is conceptually seen as something different. And this creates a lot of, this is probably in the crux of stigma and other views of mental illness, seen mainly as a variance of human behavior. Depression is really linked with the death of neurons and neuronal circuits. And many of the treatments for depression have now been proven to have a common pathway. They work through a cascade of mechanisms, but the common pathway of that is the stimulation of a special brain growth factor called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. And many of our treatments, including medication, including ECT, TMS, psychotherapy, work through the same mechanism by increasing the concentration of the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, which in turn stimulates the undifferentiated cells of the brain called progenitor cells to migrate, proliferate, and develop into new neurons and neuronal circuits, which coincidentally takes approximately 10 days to 2 or 3 weeks to finish the process. And that really coincides with the treatment time you expect to see when you start the treatment with medication.
So we can observe correlations between mental health and the physical health of the brain, but what does that mean in practical terms? How can we begin to untangle the psychological and the physical, cause and effect?
Yeah, so depression is, you know, it's funny when you talk about, is it a biological thing or is it a psychological thing? Because it's really both. I mean, all of our psychological processes, thinking, feeling, behaving, they all have biological correlates. You know, us talking right now, there are things going on in our brain and there are, you know, neurochemicals being released and all of that sort of thing. So, it you know, depression is a biological process just like anything else is. And so one of the things that goes on with depression is that these people have dysregulations in a lot of the chemicals in their brain, and one of which, the one that we're studying, is this stress hormone, cortisol. So we see, for example, that people with depression, particularly if they've had a history of maltreatment, they tend to secrete a lot more cortisol in response to a stressor. So what we do with the people when they come in to be in our studies is we stress them out, just mildly. So we ask them to give a speech, which is stressful, and to do a really difficult arithmetic test, which is also stressful. And then we measure their level of cortisol before and during and after through saliva. And we find that these kids with a history of severe maltreatment tend to secrete a lot more cortisol. So they get this huge spike of cortisol release. And cortisol is really important. We all secrete cortisol when we're stressed out. And that's really important because it gets us ready to deal with the stressor. It's that fight, flight response. But the problem with people who've had a history of chronic maltreatment is that their body's always secreting cortisol. And cortisol in large doses can be very harmful. And it can lead to problems with regulating emotions, regulating behavior, and in its extreme, it can lead to problems with memory and can actually kill cells in particular parts of the brain that are important for those functions.
Dr. Harkness's findings that people who have experienced severe maltreatment are more vulnerable than others to depression seems to indicate that people's experiences and environments play a major role in their mental health. As Dr. Harkness explains, stress is a factor in this, but levels of sensitivity to stress may be genetic.
And in terms of stress, what I see a lot is really just a lack of understanding of how impactful stress is. And, you know, we see effects of stress on brain structure. So we do imaging research where we look at the brains of these people. And we find that certain areas of the brain are smaller. And they weren't smaller to begin with. They're smaller because of the devastating impact of stress. And in some ways, this is severe stress. I mean, this is stress that most people don't have to go through, fortunately. But even the everyday hassles accumulated over time can have a serious impact. And we're starting to realize that that can affect not only our mental health, but also our physical health, and seeing how the environment plays a strong role in our physical health as well. So what's happening with these parts of the brain getting smaller is that it's the effect of these hormones that are toxic. So they're actually killing cells in those brain areas. But the brain is a very plastic organ. So it's always changing. It's always adapting to the environment, which is good for us. And so getting out of that, acutely stressful situation, learning ways to manage stress, and again, certain medication strategies can actually help in repairing that brain tissue. So one of the big things that people are focusing on is something called, it's a chemical in the brain called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, and it is a really interesting chemical that's responsible for the generation of new synaptic connections in the brain. It's controlled by a certain gene, and so people with particular variants of this gene, again, seem to be very sensitive to stress because their bodies aren't producing as much of this factor. So people are looking at ways that they can use medications that really help with this, what's called neurogenesis, so the genesis of new synaptic connections in the brain to help repair damage that's been done by stress and depression.
Dr. Harkness's research may focus on biological responses to stress, but this does not mean that the use of her findings focuses only on the physical or the pharmaceutical.
So this real interest in the sensitivity to stress is leading to a lot of, not necessarily brand new treatments, but ways of amending current treatments to incorporate a stress focus. So the best treatment right now for depression is something called cognitive behavioral therapy, which teaches people to kind of think more adaptively about the everyday stressors that happen in one's life. And that's a way of kind of shoring up their resources and their resilience against stress. And so people are kind of amending that so that it really takes a stress resilience focus. And how can we get people who are very sensitive to stress more resilient in the face of stress? And then on the kind of pharmacology side, there are treatments that are targeting that stress hormone cortisol. And a lot of treatments that are coming out of a lot of the genetic research that's being done these days. So kind of putting those two, the medication side together with the therapy side, will hopefully be the most useful.
Dr. Milev is also seeking to translate the neurological phenomena he observes into behavioral changes.
With the stigma, with a couple of collaborators from Department of Community Health and Epidemiology, we developed a inventory of stigmatizing experiences, which measures the range of experience with stigma, but also measures the impact on the person's life these experiences had. And we published that in 2005. We have validated the scale and did the complete a large study measuring the stigmatizing experience of patients with mood disorders, specifically bipolar disorder and depression. We having done significant international work in that area. We have collaborators in a variety of different countries. We have completed a large study of 220 patients in Argentina. We have a Bulgarian sample from about 180 patients. My master's student just completed 50 or 60 patients in Korea and just returned back. So we will be able to compare some stigmatizing stigma and the effect of stigma on a person throughout the world. On a different note, what we'd like to do, and we're currently developing a course for patients or people with mental illness, in which we will be teaching them how to deal with the actual stigma in their life, in their environment, in their home, in their workplace. And we are in the starting stages of such a course, and another one of my students is working on that project right now. Majority of work on stigma has been done at the general population level. And there have been some research, including Canadian research from Calgary, that these methods and this strategy is not very effective. Stigma and the stigmatizing views and beliefs are so deeply ingrained in the society that it's very difficult to really change them, especially in adults. We may be more successful of changing these in younger people, in children or high school students. And most of the more recent work has been focused on that. But while we are waiting for the next generation to come and change these, we thought that we should be doing more for helping the actual person who lives with that day to day. And this is why we focus on developing such a course. And so far, such courses don't exist. So we see that as a very important part we want to develop.
Samuel Beckett once wrote, "We are all born mad. Some remain so." I like this quotation. Not only does it reverse our conceptions of madness, but it reminds us that sanity is a process. If we are all born mad, then mental health is no longer something that we all once had and can lose. Instead, it's something that we are in the process of developing. Mental health is no longer a binary, it's a continuum.
I'm Kat. I'm 31 years old. I am a photographer and book editor. I do editorial work for publishing companies, and I take stock photos.
And who's this one?
This is Emily. Emily is 5 months now, and she is trying to eat the microphone. No one wants to say they have depression. Being depressed in our society is not an acceptable thing to be. It's a weak thing. It's not viewed as a sickness. It's viewed as an imbalance or
a failing.
A failing. It is a failing, and people think it's a failing.
I want to talk about the experience of mental health, but I don't want to talk about being sick. Instead, I want to talk about the process.
So tell me about the binder.
This is my binder. This is the binder I got when I was doing CBT in London, Ontario. It was run by two social workers, and it is a giant fat binder that I had to do a lot of homework in. I started from the very, very beginning and went to the very, very end. So I think it was twice a week for 3 months. In the morning for 3 hours. It was a very intensive schedule. In order to be in this group, the reason I got to be in this group is because you had to be kind of high-functioning depressed. You had to be suffering from depression, but not yet at the point where you couldn't handle a course. You had to be able to sort of go there and get the help you needed and do the homework. That was part of the commitment you made when you got accepted into this course, which it was an acceptance because, as I say, a lot of people wanted help and weren't able to get it. So I was pretty, I wouldn't say I was pretty happy. In retrospect, I was pretty lucky to get the help I needed. What they don't tell you about depression is that it's a lot of it is behavioral, and once you can get the behavioral piece under your belt, you can kind of start on the cognitive piece, which was the last part, was actually listening to your negative self-talk and changing it. My first step was spending less time in bed. I was at that time sleeping like sometimes 16 hours a day. And so my first step was to just spend less time in bed and just get out of bed more.
Kat is healthy, but stigma still influences her life.
I still am very sensitive. I don't like it when people call me crazy. I don't like people joking about being crazy. Because for a while I thought I was crazy. I thought I was going crazy.
Well, and crazy is such a blanket term. For everything, you know?
Yeah, it catches everything. Like every single mental anything is under the term crazy, and none of it is particularly flattering.
Yeah. Well, and it also creates this binary where, you know, you've got crazy people and sane people. But, like, the sane people half the time, I don't think they're very sane,
no,
honestly.
No, and a lot of people have been through a lot of this stuff, and they don't talk about it. There's a ton of people who are sane, who have, you know, fought with various demons, and they don't talk about it. And so you don't actually know that half of the sane people are not as sane as they would like you to believe.
Yes. Or they've had to work for their saneness, because that somehow is a compromises you as well. To say, once I had troubles, and now I'm feeling a lot better, or I know how to cope with it.
I have that label.
Suddenly,
on
you're
my...
just completely compromised.
Absolutely, I have that label on my health records now that I've had a mental health issue, which has made me ineligible for certain insurance. It has caused all kinds of problems. I can no longer answer honestly that I've never had mental health problems on surveys and things, and that has caused me complications that it should never have caused me. I'm fine now. Like, the idea that I am somehow deficient because I've been through this problem is, to me, nonsense, but not everyone agrees with me.
What cognitive behavioral therapy gave Kat was not sanity, but flexibility. Mike Condra talks about the three elements of mental health.
So think of it as three things. The first is the capacity for us to engage in meaningful work. And meaningful work could be what we're doing now, having this interview, talking about mental health. It could be digging your garden, knitting a sweater, doing brain surgery, planning a trip to the moon, who knows. It's productive work, as distinct from destructive things such as, you know, ingesting massive amounts of illicit drugs, for example. The second is that it's the capacity to have meaningful relationships. And again, meaningful, healthy, supportive relationships. Not that you should have 17 relationships or 12 or 97 or you should have 453 friends, but that the friendships you have are supportive, nurturing, and that it's reciprocal, of course, that you nurture and support other people and they nurture and support you, and it's a healthy adult relationship, the opposite being a destructive one, which we know is bad for people's health. And the third one is the most subtle but the most important. It's the capacity to respond flexibly to changes. And again, there's a continuum there. Sometimes change happens and we're a little stuck because we've never experienced it. That's the nature of a crisis. But when we're mentally well, we are able to adapt and cope and adjust. Can't remember who said, sometimes we get our best picture of the sky when we're lying on the ground. So sometimes we need to get right down before we can jump back up again. And when we encounter difficulty, and I say that, you know, flexibility is a sign of good mental health, it doesn't mean that I'm infinitely flexible. It just means that after I go through that period of adaptation, then we're flexible.
Part of being flexible is realizing that different people need different things. This should be obvious, but it isn't always.
My name's Tony. What do? I'm a teacher. I work for a local school board, and I also work for a school for adults with disabilities, intellectual disabilities. I am well educated. I have a few degrees under my belt, and that's my background, I guess. I realized that I had an anxiety problem in my 20s. Funny enough, I didn't realize it when I was really going through the throes of it. It took another friend who was going through something similar to describe, you know, what her experiences were, for me to realize that mine were similar. At that time, it was very severe, and I became agoraphobic, and not to the extent that I wouldn't leave my house, but it was very difficult for me to leave my house. And so I had a deep need to be social, yet, you know, one of the big problems I had was social anxiety. And so I knew I had to work through it, and so I forced myself to go out of the house and to do things I needed to do. But it was difficult, and I stopped going to school for some time. A couple of the insights that I've had about, you know, my own experiences are, number one, that because I'm a philosopher by nature, my brain sort of deals with possibilities rather than probabilities. I'm not a scientist. So if anything's possible, you know, like to me, then it can happen. So it's very difficult for me to talk myself out of, and that's one of the things, one of the strategies that you do use if you have anxiety, is that you do the self-talk, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how probable is it that this will happen, you know, like, and to me that talk is not as productive because of the fact that I don't even know if that the sun will rise tomorrow, frankly. And though I function in the world as if all these, you know, these questions have answers, they don't for me. And so for me, that's one important piece.
In recognizing the limitations of some conventional therapeutic approaches to anxiety disorders, Toni simultaneously accepts herself and affirms her own personality. To recognize mental and physical realities is not to make excuses, as stigma would have it, but to find new ways to work with these realities.
I think that fight or flight, you know, experience that people with anxiety have, it does come from something absolutely biological, right? There is an imperative there in the sense that, you know, like it helped us, you know, like in caveman and woman days, you know, like flee from tigers or whatever, you know, there is the sense that it's necessary, but there's something out of whack in my experience of the world when I'm afraid of things that aren't sort of realistic, you know, realistic threats.
Toni emphasizes the importance of abandoning the paradigm of sickness and cure.
I don't know that there is something to recover from. I don't think there's a place to recover to. I think that whatever place I was before this happened, you know, no longer exists, and I'm not the person that I was when I was, you know, 18, and thank God, really, you know, for us all.
So then it's more of an evolution than a sort of, I was whole and then I was broken and then I'm fixed again. Kind of seems more productive as a narrative.
Yeah.
The idea that the self is always evolving is a liberating one. Suddenly, periods of mental ill health are no longer absolute. But as a society, we're used to thinking of adult personalities as static and unchanging. We assume that everyone is always at the same normal, and that means that discussions of mental ill health are always acts of disclosure.
I mean, it's always uncomfortable, just like, I mean, I'm queer as well, right? And it's the same discomfort that I feel in the initial disclosure of that. It's, you know, always you're braced for how somebody is going to react, you know, like if you're going to bring this up. I certainly don't go around telling people, you know, like, either, you know, like my sexual orientation or, you know, about, you know, any struggles that I might have with mental health. But it, you know, when issues come up, I feel very strongly about self-disclosing, because otherwise I feel dishonest, and I don't feel it serves me well, and I don't feel it serves my community well, I don't feel it serves my friends well. I think I self-disclose in instances sometimes when people are making comments, you know, that I feel are derogatory, or, you know, because I want them to know that, you know, and I know that I'm guilty of this too, that I'm often shocked to find out, you know, like when people have issues of, you know, mental health that aren't apparent to me, you know, and I think, what? You know, as if you look so confident and so together, and how could you have an anxiety disorder? And I'm falling prey to the same stereotypical thinking that puts us all in the closet, you know, and it is the same experience. It really is the same experience of you are closeted. So yeah, I don't want to live in a closet, and I don't want to, it's not, you know, like to me, it's a lonely place, and it just pushes other people in the closet. You know, the more that other people self-disclose, the more comfortable that I am, you know, like in my own experiences. And I can't think of anybody that I know that actually hasn't had an experience with a mental illness, you know, like really. Like the coolest people I know have struggled, and that makes me feel like I'm in pretty good company.
Once we can disclose experiences of mental ill health, despite the very real possible risks involved, we can open up the space for a larger conversation about multiple ways of understanding mental health, one that need not rest solely in the hands of experts.
For now, I'll give my name. My name is Avi. I do radio.
Good.
I cater. Okay, I'll try to tell my story. I don't have a lot of experience telling this story, and I think that I'm still figuring it out. Really, for a while, I was just kind of, like, caught in it, like, not really even knowing. I certainly, until I was about 24, so now, you know, being many years sort of struggling with OCD, didn't even really know, like, what was happening with me. I was just kind of, like, caught in the thing. Just, you know, now I would look back and say, oh, I was caught in these sort of, like, the anxiety of sort of like obsessions, and like that caused like great distress, and certainly I was like doing, you know, as continues to be the case in different ways, these like compulsive behaviors around like washing myself and things that wouldn't really make sense to other people but like totally made sense to me in terms of something that had to be done. But it was not, I was just sort of like, yeah, caught in the thing. And I, you know, which is why in some ways I feel like it's going to take a while to like unravel the various like layers of like, of stigma, of, you know, whatever it was that was keeping me from either, you know, being honest with myself about what was happening, or being honest with other people, or just even having some like knowledge of how things like anxiety, like, you know, work or impact people, other people, just sort of, because I was just kind of, you know, alone with it. And, you know, for many years, just doing a lot of hiding.
Avi talks about the impact of a workshop he went to, a discussion of mental health from the perspective of radical disability studies. As Avi observes, the term radical literally means root, and radical disability studies locates the so-called problems of mental ill health in the limited conventional idea of the normal.
That was a really important event for me to go to. It was the first time that I was introduced to a perspective that sort of helped me understand what I was going through, kind of like put it in a lens that I could understand, that was healthier, that challenged the idea of sort of a normal brain or body, and kind of not just challenged it, but traced that idea to systems of power that I very much oppose, you know, traced it to the eugenics movement and this sort of thing. And that helped me sort of at least get the seeds of starting to break down some of the sort of oppression that I had internalized by kind of, yes, sort of understanding that whatever I was sort of holding on to, some sort of standard of normalcy, was sort of arbitrary anyway, not just for me, but for everybody. I don't think that it's sort of helpful for me to look at what I'm going through as something that needs to be fixed. It's something that is like hindering my life and my agency, and I want to have that agency. And so that's going to involve change. But I think that, you know, looking at myself as something to fix really just kind of brings me back to the realm of stigma that in a lot of ways got me here in the first place. And that's painful in and of itself, right? In terms of not, you know, for a long time not wanting to like out myself as having like a broken brain who does these totally absurd things in the eyes of most people. And it's like, to me, the problem is that it take those things that I do take away from that agency. It's not that they're perceived as absurd, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like I could spend hours washing a chair that I sat on and my furniture and, you know, with like soap and water and my computer and whatever else. And the problem with that, I mean, there could be a number of practical problems with it, but is that doesn't feel like healthy to be, for me, it takes up a lot of time. It's stressful. It's distressing. It, you know, there's personal, like there's mental anxiety of various sorts. Those are the problems with it. The problem isn't that it will be perceived as being absurd and crazy. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, that's what I thought the main problem was with it. Was how I would be perceived and how other people would look at me, and that it was, you know, very important for me to not be looked upon that way, to be looked at as like normal.
Radical new ways of thinking about mental health proliferate beyond radical disability studies. Author Mark Freeman explains.
Oh, my name is Mark Freeman.
And what do you do?
I am. Maybe ask me that again. I mean, everybody has a brain, so everybody has mental health. Just the same, everybody has cardiovascular health, and everybody has improvable and varying levels of cardiovascular health. Everybody has improvable and varying levels of mental health. We really need to get to this point where we stop seeing mental health as this division, that there are somehow that there are sane people and that there are insane people, or there are ill people and there are healthy people. It's just not true. I mean, anytime when we're talking about bodies, there are just varying levels of health. When we talk about physical bodies, it's not as though there are Olympic athletes and everyone else is sick. So it's the same in mental health. Everyone is on this continuum, and health is made up of an accumulation of healthy activities.
Mark's book is called The Path to Change. It's a workbook on exposure response therapy for people with OCD. But unlike many other self-help books, it's written from the perspective of someone who's gone through the process himself.
I wanted to share my personal story because I wanted people to see this person does a lot of the same things that I do. And so that can either help them see that, oh, if I keep doing these things, I'm just going to get unhealthier and unhappier. But also to see, hey, you know, a lot of these things that I thought were normal are actually making me ill. And so a lot of telling the personal story, though, is also telling my own personal stories about getting healthy. And I wanted that to be an emphasis of it. I think sometimes when we're sharing personal stories about mental health, we just have this tendency to focus on the illness. So we sort of approach living as though people are just going to do it. Like you throw people out into the world and somehow they're just going to be great at living. So I use the example in the book of, you know, we haven't evolved an innate ability to swim. Theoretically, humans and our ancestors have been around water for a very long time. And yet, if you don't teach someone how to swim, they drown very quickly. And yet, we don't focus on teaching ourselves how to live in this world. a lot of mental health issues just stem from an inability to handle uncertainty. So starting to look at different ways that we can incorporate positive risk into educational programs. And in the same way that we, you know, we have physical education classes and we teach people how to do physical sports, we also have to learn how to do mental sports. We have to learn how to embrace uncertainty. There's just this assumption that people are going to develop these abilities well. And that simply isn't the case. And yeah, if it was in an educational context, it'd be about learning how to do things in a healthy way. And yeah, just in general, embrace uncertainty. Give it a hug.
We still have a lot to discover about mental health, both from a research perspective and in terms of our cultural conversation. But Mark thinks we have every reason to be hopeful.
Let's see. No, I think, if I was to say anything, I think we are at the start of a revolution in mental health where people recognize they can be open about mental health. And this is going to fundamentally change how we deal with mental health. People will start to see, particularly with advances that are happening in neuroscience right now, we're going to be better at diagnosing mental health issues. Right now in mental health, with a lot of disorders, people get divided up into different categorizations when really they're dealing with much more fundamental issues. So because there's been such an emphasis on behavior over the years, we look at two different symptoms and we decide that that person has two different disorders, which is a lot like if you had, I don't know, a throat infection. So you had a sore throat and a runny nose, and you went into the doctor and the doctor said you have comorbid snot and coughing disorders. And we know that's not true when we talk about physical health. But for some reason that way of diagnosing persists in mental health. So someone has a problem with anxiety, and it exhibits itself as an eating disorder, a substance dependence disorder, and depression. We then say that person has three different disorders. And they'll actually get treated in three different treatment programs. Two of those treatment programs, actually the eating disorder treatment program, because there's a substance abuse problem, the eating disorder program won't accept the person. That's a huge issue, and I think we're going to start to see that change because of advances in neuroscience. We're going to be better at diagnosing disorders, and we're going to look at more fundamental issues at the core of problems and not get so caught up in symptoms.
This documentary is the product of the radio residency program at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. The radio residency program was made possible by grants from the City of Kingston and the Kingston Arts Council. I spoke with Mike Condra, Kate Harkness, Rumen Milev, Kavita Basundio, and Kevin Imrie from Queen's University. Thanks to Avi, Kat, Tony, Tiffany, and Mark for telling me their stories. Mark Freeman's book, The Path to Change, will soon be available online from Taketomi Media at www.taketomimedia.com. Production assistance by Avi G, Saida Jaffer, Fraser McPherson, and Christiana Clemens. Music by Discount Fireworks and Nomo, available from the Free Music Archive.